You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 15th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. From Midori House in London, and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, we're live in Harare with the latest on the apparent coup against Robert Mugabe. Is his near 40-year rule of Zimbabwe really over? And if so, what happens next? Should Donald Trump really be allowed to authorise a nuclear strike on his own? That's under discussion in Congress, and later we'll hear from a man who, for a short time, held that exact same power. US politicians are soon to get mandatory training on sexual harassment. And later we'll hear from the CEO of a lifestyle and branding firm who says more high-profile abusers are yet to be publicly identified. We'll also find time to reflect on Australia's decision to allow same-sex marriage. Plus the top stories from across Asia. All coming up in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, let's take a look at some of the day's other top news stories. The president of Lebanon has, for the first time, accused Saudi Arabia of detaining its prime minister. Saad Hariri resigned at the start of the month, claiming his life was in danger, but critics said he was acting on instructions from Riyadh. Michel Aoun now says there is no justification for his continued absence and has called it an act of aggression against Lebanon. At least 14 people have been killed in flash flooding in Greece. Heavy overnight rain caused the flooding, with towns west of the capital, Athens, worst affected. Many of the victims were elderly people found inside their homes. It follows a week of very heavy rain across large parts of the country. Russian MPs have approved plans for a law which would allow the government to list any foreign media operating in the country as a foreign agent. It's retaliation for the move to force the Kremlin-backed RT to register as a foreign agent in the United States over claims that it tried to interfere in last year's presidential election. And an Iranian weightlifter who won a gold medal at the Rio Olympics is to auction that medal to raise money for victims of last week's earthquake in the country. Kianush Rustami says he wants to help the thousands of people who were caught up in the quake. More than 400 were killed and close to 10,000 others were injured in the magnitude 7.3 quake, which was close to the border between Iran and Iraq. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First this evening, Robert Mugabe is tonight thought to be under house arrest after a day that's seen the military take control in the country's capital. Hours after the head of the army was accused by Mr. Mugabe's ZANU-PF party of treason, gunfire was heard and military vehicles took to the streets. Troops took over state television amid reports of a coup. Military leaders have said that is not the case, but it does seem increasingly likely that Mugabe's 37-year rule in Zimbabwe is now over. Well, in a moment, we will assess the long-term implications. But first, let's cross to Grace Mutanda, who's a writer based in Harare, who joined us on last night's programme. Grace, thank you for joining us once again. Last night, you said that the next 24 hours was going to be critical for the future of Zimbabwe. It turned out you really weren't wrong.
Yes, because we were expecting something of the sort of what has happened to happen, actually, but we're not very sure how it was going to pan out. But early this morning at 4 a.m., we discovered that the military had actually taken over and were reassuring the people that the head of state and his family were safe, and that this was not a military coup, but that they were just trying to fix things that had been messed up. And as soon as that was done, they would actually go back to their barracks.
So what is the situation in Harare tonight?
Well, there's still an air of uncertainty because people don't know what's going to happen. There was speculation that maybe right now, during the afternoon, they were discussing transitional arrangements, civilian transitional arrangements. But it seems like there is a standoff of some sort maybe President Mugabe is refusing to relinquish power. We don't know because there isn't any information coming out except rumors.
And what about the reaction of people in Harare to the events of the last day? What's been the mood on the street?
The mood on the streets has been one of, excitement and happiness that this has happened, because the truth is that there are many people who we felt that the president had overstayed and they wanted him gone, and they were happy that the military had been able to do it. While some people felt that the military should not be used to meddling in governments in government matters, there were still some people who thought maybe that was the only route that could be taken at this moment.
Grace, thank you for joining us again this evening. Grace Mutanda, who's a writer based in Harare. Joining me in the studio is Winston Mano, who's the director of the Africa Media Centre at the University of Westminster. Thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting me.
So the military insisting in statements on radio and television through the day that this is not a coup. It looks an awful lot like a coup, though.
I think... To some extent, it is not a coup, because when a person is organizing a coup, they don't announce it in advance. These soldiers, they actually informed, the nation, although their message was not broadcast, that they would intervene if certain conditions. They didn't want to be insulted. They were saying that they were unhappy with the way the Mugabe government was running the economy. They were also unhappy with the way those who participated in the struggle were being purged from the government. So to put things into perspective, it's very important to understand that these guys, the guys that carried out the war of liberation, they were in the bushes, in the trenches, fighting for the liberation of Zimbabwe. So what we have is a group of people who are close to Mugabe, who were very much thinking that the current leader, who is close to 94 now, is not passing on the baton stick to them, is monopolizing power. And in their view, they are actually acting against a bedroom coup. They are preventing that. They are offering, a solution. I think what one of them said today and yesterday is very important. They said that what they executed is not a coup, but it's a corrective measure to try and, get the attention of their commander-in-chief, who is still with them, Robert Mugabe. So in my view, when you want to understand this, put it into perspective, but also try and understand the way President Robert Mugabe has not managed the succession issue well. He has, I think, with his wife, tried to maybe create a sort of a family dynasty.
Without anybody else.
That has been part of the accusation from some of his colleagues. But I think critically what we have is maybe a lack of, connection with the larger group, which is actually in the army. The general who is leading this is General Major Chiwenga, and most of the senior army guys are with him. And what they are saying is Mugabe is still our leader. And
that implies that after holding him under house arrest for a period, that they envisage a way in which he can return as president and manage a transition that they approve of. But surely whatever authority Mugabe had evaporated the moment the military took away his power.
Yes, I think when you want to analyze this, you want to also to think of how Mugabe was actually closer to his wife and other colleagues than to these army generals. So there was a gap in their communication. So In desperation, the army commanders on Monday issued a very strongly worded statement, hoping that they will get the attention of their commander-in-chief. Apparently, this did not happen, and what we now know happened is that there were statements from the youth in support of, which were very critical of the army, calling them deadwood and insulting them. Many people thought, these people don't know that these are actually soldiers. They are not, as they were saying on social media, they are not members of the Salvation Army. They are real army soldiers. So what we have, therefore, is, in my view, a conflation of the party constitution and the national constitution. The two have now got us into this crisis. The way in which the party constitution has failed to ensure a smooth transition from Robert Mugabe to another, generation of leaders has meant that has now, spilled over into the national space. And we are now faced with this crisis, which even in the region, they would rather believe that, what is happening in Zimbabwe is a squabble between, members of one political party. The sooner this is resolved, then it will be business as usual, between Zimbabwe and other countries.
The implication of that, this morning when people woke up to the news of what had happened in Harare, obviously there are a lot of people scattered around the world who, it is fair to say, are no fans of Robert Mugabe, and greeted this news effectively, quite happily, the thought that he may have been overthrown. If it's painted as an internal struggle inside ZANU-PF in which one faction will be triumphant against another and will see the leadership of the country develop in the direction they want, that implies that the sort of changes that, say, the opposition in Zimbabwe and that some human rights groups and others have been campaigning for a long time is no nearer as a consequence of what's happened today.
Yeah, I think your question is very important. But what you should bear in mind is that even the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, has accepted, has welcomed this, intervention. They think that any change, is a good thing for the country, and maybe we can kickstart our democratization process. So what we have is an impasse that is likely to be resolved by this move. And like what Grace was saying, the mood, when one looks at the reaction of Zimbabweans, I'm here, so I look at social media postings. Some people are very enthusiastic about this because it refreshes the political process. But others are placing a word of caution, because once we have military guys coming in, then it becomes like something that is recurrent, that can come back again. So a lot of people are trying to understand what is the meaning of this. If it's likely that, as Grace was saying, that President Mugabe talks to his generals and they find an amicable solution so that there is no spillage of blood, then surely it will be a very important step in Zimbabwe's democratization process that there is a post-Mugabe era.
Well, do you think that inevitably they are still saying he is their commander-in-chief, they want him to listen to them, but do you think that the eventual solution of this crisis inevitably does involve a transfer of power away from Robert Mugabe to somebody else, even if that somebody else has to be someone that the army approves of?
Yes, it has to involve him, because these guys, if they are citing the liberation struggle and they want to continue with that past, that what we are doing is to continue the revolution. He is an important part of the revolution, but the question is, does he want to be part of that continuity, or does he want to just think, look, I will not bless the actions, I will not talk to them. if he does that unreasonably, so even some of his closest colleagues will turn their back on him. But if he shows concern and, you know, he listens to them and he says, I'm commander-in-chief, I'm the person in charge, it's my job to talk to them and find an amicable solution, then perhaps Zimbabwe can get to the next stage. But if there's a continued standoff, it's likely to be, you know, perhaps something that results in, a conflict that, it will escalate matters. So one would think that, you know, the various parties involved, they heed the word from SADC, from the African Union, that they should talk and resolve this amicably so that there's no unnecessary killings here.
Winston, thank you very much for your time and your insight this evening. Winston Munro from the African Media Centre at the University of Westminster.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, Russia has come to the rescue for Venezuela, which is struggling to restructure huge amounts of debt. The move came days after rating agencies warned that Caracas was now in default on several of its international bonds. Well, Moscow's move provides some breathing space, but it also raises a few questions about why it's doing it. Well, let's explore those now with Oscar Gardiella-Lavella, who's a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck, University of London, and is the author of the book What If Latin America Ruled the World? Oscar, Russia has presumably not agreed this debt relief for Venezuela out of the goodness of its heart. It's doing it because it buys it gratitude and influence.
Not only that, it also seems to be a good move from a purely business standpoint. There are two parallel stories with the restructuring of Venezuela's debt. One has to do with the fact that Rosneft, the Russian oil company, seems to be gaining a foothold on the operations of PDVSA, the Venezuela's money maker, which does not suffer the same, lack of liquidity as the Venezuelan government does. And so it seems to be the case that Rosneft is gaining control over the oil operations of PDVSA, which have been marred by corruption and incompetence, and is actually using some of that control in order to export some crude oil from Venezuela to India and then to Iran. Russia bought a couple of refineries in India recently. So there may be another story developing here. There is the political side, but there is also the business side.
We know that Rosneft is a pretty aggressive company that wants to expand pretty aggressively. I mean, is there a chance here that Venezuela could turn around one day and find that actually its most precious asset now belongs to Moscow?
Well, actually, part of the deal included a 49.9% or 51% stake in Citgo, the Venezuela's, PDVSA's U.S. subsidiary. That already tells us that there is an influence. Of course, in the case of Citgo, there are other talks. There are talks between PDVSA and Rosneft because the U.S. is, of course, quite concerned about Russian company gaining that sort of a stake in a U.S. Subsidiary. So it might be the case that we're seeing the growing influence of Rosneft in particular, but Russia in general, the Venezuelan case.
And what we've also seen is that both Russia and also China have emerged as alternative sources of finance for countries that are struggling economically, which waters down the power, the influence that organizations like the IMF have had in terms of their ability to loan huge sums of money to a country and then say, and here are all the strings that are attached to it. Presumably the strings that come with Russian or Chinese money are different.
Absolutely. I mean, we have seen this sort of thing in the last decade and a half. I mean, part of what the pink tide meant in Latin America was that it was an element of a wider geopolitical move. The U.S. is no longer the only playing town, and so Latin American countries moved towards China and Russia. That is still the case, and indeed, although the sanctions imposed by the European Union and the U.S. are biting Venezuela, it is the case that this move, as Venezuela's agriculture minister, who was in Moscow signing this deal, put it, is of a strategic importance, meaning this is geopolitics as much as it is business.
You mentioned the U.S. there being concerned. You mentioned earlier about a Russian company taking these kind of stakes. But with the US under the leadership of somebody who is very much interested in America first, are they in a position to counter a move by Russia to gain more influence in Latin American countries?
Probably not. I mean, it is very interesting. This story is very interesting because you see two things. On the one hand, liquidity has become a sort of military weapon. It is used precisely in order to strangle an economy, provoke a regime change. On the other hand, because most of these operations take place in the open market, it's not a lot you can really do in order to stop them without looking yourself as a like a protectionist. So it is the case that the U.S. has expressed concern, and it does seem that there are conversations taking place between PDVSA and Rosneft to make sure the stake is exchanged for other assets.
Are there other countries in the region where Russia might be looking with interest at offering more assistance with strings?
Certainly. I mean, it would be interesting to see what happens next year with elections in Brazil. If, as polls indicate so far, Lula wins, we might see that kind of move also in Brazil.
And when you talk about Venezuela, we talked about the risk of having some of its assets suddenly finding its assets are under Russian control. There isn't really much it can do about it, though, is it? It's got debts, sovereign debts of $60 billion. It has to take the help wherever the help comes from.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be the biggest default in history. For now, it's a partial default. PDVSA, as I pointed out, which is the Venezuela's money maker, is in a much better position. The focus right now is to keep PDVSA clean, let's put it that way. Insofar as Caracas has to do whatever it can do in order to avoid further debt, and also, the position is shifting. The government has, Venezuela's government has said that they are ready to keep paying, but not if it if the price is the continuing suffering of its people. There is a sort of vicious circle between servicing debt and keeping the shortages that are now causing so much suffering to Venezuela's people. So that if that is the case, then the best thing to do is to look for help elsewhere. And of course, China and Russia are there. They have been there since the beginning of the century.
Oscar, thank you very much. That's Oscar Gutierrez-Rivière from Birkbeck University in London. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, it's something that clearly goes with the territory of being commander-in-chief, and it's something that, until recently, most people didn't necessarily think about. But should the President of the United States actually be able, on his own, to order a nuclear strike? For the first time in four decades, Congress is debating whether there should be restraints on Donald Trump's ability to order the use of the ultimate weapon. We're joining me with more now is Dan Glickman, a former congressman himself, who now is Vice President of the Aspen Institute. Given the president's threat over the summer to unleash what he called fire and fury on North Korea, you can understand why there's more nervousness about this than before, because Donald Trump does feel like the kind of person who might be quite keen on using nuclear weapons at some point.
Well, I have actually worried about this myself. I was in the Congress for many, many years and also was in the Clinton cabinet during the presidency of Bill Clinton. And I basically have called for much more congressional involvement in the whole process of the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, on the one hand, we need to make sure there are protocols and processes that are available so that nuclear weapons aren't used frivolously. God forbid you could kill hundreds of millions of people that way. On the other hand, if the United States is being attacked or if there is an imminent attack threatening, you can't call a joint session of Congress together because of time constraints. So it's a very, very tricky kind of a problem. But I am heartened to see that the Congress is finally taking a long, serious look at it, because really it is, under our Constitution, the Congress that has the power to declare war, not the president.
And yet it is perhaps a glaring omission in that system that it's Congress that declares war, but it's the president who has the sole authority to order what would be a colossal act of war.
Well, I mean, you know, it's strange. It's under our Constitution, the president is the commander-in-chief, and he is the one to execute the war. It's complicated by the speed of let's say, a potential threat. Let's say a nuclear missile is heading to the United States, or we have very good intelligence that it's heading the United States. What do you do? Well, you can't call a joint session of Congress together because the missile can be on the doorsteps of New York or Washington within 20 minutes. At the same time, you need to make sure that there are processes in place so that there are others in the chain of command that are involved in that decision-making. It could be the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of the State, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, if possible, the leadership in Congress. At a minimum, it's healthy that we take a look at it. You know, I frankly don't like a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the White House. It did worry me. At the same time, I'm somewhat heartened by the fact that there are thoughtful people around the president right now, and I don't think that we have anything imminently to worry about. The heat of his rhetoric, I think, has caused some concern from people. But if nothing else, Congress needs to engage in order to build some processes in the system to know how and what is going to actually happen. So there will not be any frivolous use of nuclear weapons.
Now, a retired general told these congressional hearings that theoretically the military could refuse an order to launch a strike if they didn't believe that order to be proportional. But however much some people may dislike the current president, if the military starts saying it might countermand instructions it doesn't like, you start to move awfully close to a coup.
That's correct. On the other hand, if a nuclear strike that has the potential to wiping out, you know, hundreds of millions of people puts us into a position that the founding fathers of this country 200 years ago never even quite contemplated. That's why, you know, you need processes in place. You need verification orders in place. And it's not just a frivolous act of a president. I mean, what if there's a cyber intrusion? There was a movie years ago called War Games, which was a little bit of a ridiculous, a comedy game, but it was a cyber problem caused by a bad machine controlling the utilization of nuclear weapons that almost caused a thermonuclear war. So it's not just a frivolous act of a president. It could be a cyber attack or anything else. So the Congress really does need to just fully examine this and bring us up to a more modern times.
Now, you have a rather close personal experience to this, as you were once sat in a room with, in theory, should the worst happen, the power to order a nuclear strike.
Well, God forbid. Fortunately, I didn't know the magnitude. I was under our rules since I was in the cabinet, and it's based upon the chain of when you came into the cabinet. If something were to happen to wipe out the entire cabinet and basically the Congress of the United States, they have a designated survivor. And one year, many years ago, it was 20 years ago, I was the designated survivor. And so I had at my disposal the nuclear capability of setting this process in motion. I must tell you that I don't think I was 100% thoroughly briefed on the consequences. This was before 9/11, and I'm not sure that it was handled at that time as seriously as it is certainly being handled now. Now the processes are much more serious and much more secure than they were back then.
Of course, the notion of the designated survivor has since become the topic of an extremely cheesy TV drama.
Well, actually, it's a pretty good TV drama. The guy who was chosen to be the designated survivor was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And, of course, I always thought the Department of Agriculture that I was the secretary was the most important department. But beyond that, you know, you wonder why the Secretary of the Defense or the Secretary of State isn't the designated survivor. It does make you think that you need somebody there who can act, who, you know, has some connection with war making on a more daily basis. I do think that the processes have been improved significantly since the 20 years that I was in this particular role as the Secretary of Agriculture. And, of course, nothing happened. President Clinton gave a speech, and I was actually taken to New York because my daughter lived there. I wasn't really in a very secure location. Speech was over. You know, it was done, and I could go back to my daily life. But I think it is useful for us to know that the use of nuclear weapons is such a profound power that, and yet at the same time, it requires speed, and especially if you're under attack or under imminent attack, that it is really important that even though Congress can't debate if you're under an imminent threat, it must get involved initially to determine if there are processes and protocols in place to prevent against somebody using that power frivolously.
Dan, thank you very much for explaining that to us. And I promise to go back and revisit that TV program now. Dan Glickman there, joining us on The Daily here on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
There's barely a major industry left now that hasn't been hit by the sexual harassment scandal. Hollywood and politics, of course, are at the front of the line. And indeed, in Washington, US lawmakers have now been told they will get mandatory training after allegations of harassment and abuse, in some cases, on the floor of the House of Representatives. The fashion industry hasn't been immune either, with the allegations against the photographer Terry Richardson, which led to many organizations refusing to work with him. Well, for more on this, we can talk to Kim Vernon, president and CEO of the lifestyle and branding company, The Vernon Company. She joins us on the line now. Let's go back to Washington first, if we may, because the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, has outlined a plan for mandatory training, but it is only after two congresswomen told a panel about misconduct that had gone unchallenged for years.
Yes, I think what Paul Ryan's doing might be a little bit of politics, but none the matter, what he's doing is correct, and it is what many public companies, including one that I worked for, Calvin Klein, and owned by PVH, required their employees to do was racial and sexual harassment training. And I think that there are not enough companies and organizations that do this, no matter how silly it may seem. So it's a really wonderful move when the government is making that statement. I do believe, and we've seen some very important actions taken by Kering and LVMH with Henri Pinault and the Arnauds in creating a charter to instill integrity, respect, and responsibility in the way they work with outside talent. So this is happening, and it's a global happening, and I think it's just the beginning.
One issue with that, if a company is effectively acknowledging that there may be a problem with harassment, making its employees go on these courses, making it mandatory, then presumably the next step of that is that you have to police it. And if there are people who transgress against those rules, you have to then be seen to be taking action to protect people.
I do believe you have a point, and there is a gray area in how these things are policed and how they're processed. But I think what's happening in my industry, which is fashion, lifestyle, brands, is a bit specific to the nature of the work that is done using models and using people in position of creative power, photographers, art directors, brands. And by nature, with models, you know, there's a goal to be famous, there's a goal to be earning well, and so there is a gray area. When it comes to the public sector of companies and government and industry, I think in general we have a problem with race and with gender inequality.
If you look at that issue, say, around models, for example, we had the issue around the photographer Terry Richardson a few weeks ago, and there was a situation where people, after it was reported on in the press, said, this has been an open secret, much like the Harvey Weinstein story and all these other issues. People say, this has been an open secret within this industry for a very long time. And the long-term question, I suppose, the test of this is not so much sending people on courses, but more that notion that within certain industries, certain types of behaviour have just been tolerated. Is the test is that it won't be tolerated in the future?
Yeah, so you made a very good point. There has been a culture of it's okay, first promoted by the agencies, who I think are very complicit in the way they communicated to model and talent about what they were expected to do if they wanted to make money and be famous. And I think, yes, Terry is a long open secret. You're going to see, and I think very soon, some more very significant stories come out about superpower talents that are important in my industry. And I think it's a very real correction in what the brands who are paying the bills will allow, which is why what Kering and LVMH did and what Sarah Ziff is doing with Model Alliance are very, very important. I think that the past will not move into the future. It will not be acceptable anymore when people are creating these environments of it's okay and complicity on those kind of sets and those kind of shoots and situations. I think those days are gone.
Now, you said a moment ago that you thought that there were more stories to emerge, more big names to emerge in stories. Now, if you look back to the Harvey Weinstein story, with the recent piece in the New Yorker that went into detail about these allegations that he had for some time been instructing people to gather damaging information about some of his victims that could be used to discredit them. Do you think there are other people in similar positions who are either worrying that their name is about to come out or are trying to build up information that would enable them to mount some kind of defense were their name to come out?
I think both are about to happen. I think you're going to find some very serious journalism related to particular individuals' abuse of power, whether they understood that they were abusing or not abusing is a gray area. And I think that people are at the same time preparing because they very well know that based on what they're seeing the accusations are and the results of those accusations, they better be prepared. So I don't think it's the end of it. And I think that it's okay. I do think there is a gray area. I've worked on sets as an executive, Calvin Klein, where you have some talent that are extraordinarily comfortable and volunteer to be more sensual and present themselves in a way to get a great picture, and you have some that are much more conservative, and it's how you respect what that talent wants to do that makes you the better or the worse situation.
We've talked about what the long-term tests of whether this will change anything might be, and I suppose as much as the last few weeks have given victims of abuse and harassment an opportunity to speak out and a communal voice, how much real long-term change do you think there would be? If we revisited this in 2027, where do you think we would be?
2027, I think we'll be in a very different place. I think, you know, thanks to social media and thanks to the charters of people like LVMH and Kering and Condé Nast for refusing to work with people that behave intolerably, and thanks to Paul Ryan, if we can thank him, and thanks to the ability for people to speak out, I think it will make people more cautious in utilizing or manipulating a situation to their advantage in a potentially harassing situation. I don't think we're going to become the most conservative world on the planet. People will be people, and there are some people that are not put in positions. But I do think that in the corporate world, people are going to look and think hard before they act wrongly towards talent that are vulnerable and people that are being paid to perform, which is akin to the entertainment industry.
Kim, thank you very much for your time this evening. Kim Vernon, the president and CEO of the Vernon Company, joining us there on the line. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Well, now it's time for Tall Stories, the weekly feature from the team behind The Urbanist. Every week it goes on a different urban journey. This week it's our editor, Andrew Tuck, who takes us to London's East End, where a short strip of street is transformed every Sunday morning into an urban garden.
In London's East End, there's a short strip of street that every Sunday morning transforms into a quivering canopy of foliage through which Londoners squeeze in search of a nice potted plant, something to cheer up a neglected patch, or a bunch of blooms to take to a sick neighbour. The flower market at Columbia Road has been around for decades, and there's been a market of some sort here dating back to the 1860s. Today, its evergreen appeal is down to several nicely arranged factors. Firstly, the Victorian street is also home to lots of compact shops, selling crafts and gifts and bagels. There's a strong Jewish link in this part of the East End. Oh, and also good coffee. Meanwhile, the neighbouring Ezra Street looks like a facade for a movie set in Victorian times, with its cobbles, lantern lamps, and tiny Sunday market. And thirdly, even the buskers aren't painful. No human statues here. It's a good mix of the tarted up and proper old school East End. The stallholders holler, cajole and utter the occasional saucy comment, and a proper in-the-blood market people. It's where those whose families have lived here for generations and also the Aravis literally rub shoulders. Going to the market regularly also keeps Londoners in tune with the changing seasons. Spring is when the number of punters begins to climb like a creeper, as big ambitions for making a go of the garden come into play. People push through the throng, waylaid with bedding plants and bunches of daffs for their windowsills too. Summer delivers another round of perhaps two in bloom beauties, such as heavily white-blossomed hydrangeas and breeze-bristling bamboos. Autumn is for bulbs, and December, of course, for Christmas trees and wreaths. The seasons shape the very scent of the street. Many people go for no more than a gander, but they leave with a sense of having, on a Sunday morning, been surrounded by a mixed bag of humanity, all united in a hope of making some corner prettier than when they woke up. It's a bit of London that is very London. A piece that makes you realise why the city can enthrall you when it takes its fancy to do so, and shows how the humble market is a genius social mixer. It's flower power for a new generation.
Andrew Tuck with this week's Tall Story. Well, for more of the cities we live in, The Urbanist is at 1900 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24. Still to come, Australia back same-sex marriage, and in just a moment, some of the top stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
We turn to Asia now and some of the stories that are making headlines there. My guest, John Hemmings, the founding director of the Asia Studies Centre at the Henry Jackson Society. Let's begin in Japan with a political resignation.
Yes, this is Yuriko Koike, the governor of Tokyo, who kind of burst out of nowhere in October with a new party, the Party of Hope, Kibo no To, and seemed to put on a very good rhetorical challenge to the government LDP party of Shinzo Abe. She did not do as well in the election on the 22nd. They got something like 50 seats, although putting forward something like 300 candidates. And so she has fallen from grace. She was going to have to jump from one or the other. She couldn't continue as governor of the city and run the new party. So she's getting flack from a very difficult choice, to be honest. But nevertheless, it does strike one as a little bit foolhardy to have gambled so high. And to some extent, it sets the flavor of what's happening in Tokyo politics and what's happening in many countries, where you see a very strong government party and then the opposition in disarray or disintegration.
Which, of course, allows the governing party to not get away with things, but to act without having to worry about too much scrutiny.
Absolutely. I mean, she set herself up in the advert that I watched as kind of a challenge to the status quo. And yet almost every policy position was quite supportive of similar positions of Shinzo Abe. She was also conservative, social conservative, and also similar-minded on constitutional reform. And then to tie it all off, she kept liberals out of the party. She wasn't taking who were falling out of the Democrat Party, and indicated she might tie up with the LDP once she won power. So people who were looking for change weren't really finding it with her.
And it's interesting. I suppose that you would have taken the gamble, because when the election was called, a lot of people thought this is a bit of a risk that Shinzo Abe's taken. This could backfire quite badly. And then in the end, of course, it worked out better than maybe even he hoped. So you can understand that the temptation to take the plunge.
Yeah, I met her before, and she is an impressive person. She speaks Arabic. She's a journalist by trade originally. She was a Middle East expert. And so kind of an unusual political leader for Japan, certainly, where many come out of law, or they come out of Todai and Kyodai, the kind of typical policy universities. So she has this very fascinating background. She's a woman, which in Japan, again, amongst the political elites is unusual. So she's done great to get this far, but it is a serious misstep.
And now, we were talking a little earlier in the program about Russia trying to increase its influence over businesses in South America. And now a story about Chinese firms dominating another big sector, financial technology.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. So just today, KPMG and a global consultancy company, and H2 Ventures, an Australian investment company, released this kind of big, trade in this sector. It's the big number. It's called FinTech 100. It's top 100 companies that are going through in financial technology. I think 50 of them are supposed to be the current giants, and then 50 are supposed to be the challengers. And very interestingly, China is beginning to dominate on both ends of the spectrum. I think out of the top 10, five, no less, were Chinese. Three were American, and one Brit, one German. So in some way, because it is such a new type of industry, it's a shakeup of old financial technologies. AI is coming through, new types of online payments are coming through. And because of that innovative new playing field, the Chinese are at no disadvantage whatsoever. If they're the latest to the party, in some ways they're at an absolute advantage to that.
But it's going to concern countries like the US.
I think to some extent there will be dangers in it if that becomes a global dominance, in which, as we saw, like the top one, Ant Financial, which is owned by Alibaba, they tried to buy a very, very big American company. I think it's called, I'm trying to get the name in front of me. The company that they were trying to buy, it was one of the very old kind of U.S. Financial wiring companies. And the danger that was noted by American investigators from CFIUS, the kind of Committee for Foreign Investment on this, was that American soldiers tend to use this service. And so if a Chinese firm were able to, you have to own the American company, they would have access data to just huge amounts of privileged data, essentially, of American soldiers, including how much money they had, whether they're in debt, all kinds of kind of...
You wouldn't necessarily want the Chinese state to have.
Yeah, and so once again, you're seeing with with authoritarian capitalist states who are becoming powerful leaders in financial and online data, you know, where are the risks? And we all, of course, want to welcome investment, but how do we screen that and make sure that it's used responsibly in a way that liberal democracies expect of their, you know, people expect of their own governments?
Very nearly out of time, but just briefly, I'm intrigued by the last story. North Koreans asking a question quite a lot of people are asking, whether Donald Trump is crazy.
I got this story because there's a lot more to it than just the kind of flash headline. So this is a woman, Susan DiMaggio, who's a senior fellow at the New American Foundation. She regularly meets with the North Koreans. I find this kind of person to be more interesting than all the screaming headlines about tweeting this and tweeting that and all the insults they're exchanging these days. The interesting thing that she's discovered is that they're asking, is he really crazy? In other words, they don't know if it's an act or not. So that's number one. I find that very, very fascinating. That's quite troubling if our opponents can't tell if, you know, the leader of the free world is actually putting on an act or not. Second one, will he be around for them to negotiate with? Now, we saw he put out some friendly feelers while he was on his Asia trip and said, I'd like to be friends with him. If they don't know whether he'll last 2 or 3 months...
maybe they won't bother.
Exactly.
They're only asking what we're all asking. John, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. John Hemmings, thanks very much. Well, finally, on tonight's Daily, the world has been showing a lot of love to Australia today after it voted to legalise same-sex marriage. More than 60% of the people who took part in a postal referendum backed it. Now, it's not binding on the government in Canberra, but ministers have promised legislation within months. Well, earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to the political and foreign affairs journalist Carol Walker and Daniela Pellard, and he started by asking whether it was perhaps unusual it had taken Australia so long to catch up with the rest of the world.
Well, it does, and I think it's definitely a positive move that Australia has seen the light and decided to sanction same-sex marriage. We've had it in this country, but it's worth remembering in the UK, same-sex marriage was introduced by David Cameron back in 2014. I remember sitting in the conference hall as he announced it to his party that he was going to back it with this great flourish, an announcement that was met with a deafening silence from many of the very conservative members who were listening to him. So it's not that long that it's been in place here. And it was interesting to note that many European countries, including Italy, Switzerland, Greece, and of course Northern Ireland, still don't recognise same-sex marriage. So it is certainly, I think, welcome that Australia has taken this step. I think it is a step that will perhaps change some of the perceptions that many people outside the country do have of Australians. And let's hope that it prompts many of those other countries who have yet to recognise this to follow the lead that Australia is setting. Fascinating to think that on social policy, Australia is ahead of the Swiss.
Only just, unfortunately. Daniela, I was, to declare a position here, among those who thought that the plebiscite option was a terrible, terrible, terrible idea, not least because it would just turn into the circus that it did. Is there anything to be said for that idea? I mean, I can see that on the one hand, you do get this indisputable endorsement by a big majority of people saying this is the kind of country we want to be. On the other hand, I just think it's weird to give... to put the civil rights of a minority up for debate by the majority to be sort of awarded or removed at the whim of their fellow citizens.
Well, I think there's place for these kinds of measures. I mean, I think the idea of a plebiscite is kind of bonkers, and it was a postal vote, as it were, which took 2 months. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You can look at the experience of Ireland, which had a referendum 2 years ago, and there, I mean, strangely, considering the previous power of the Catholic Church, similar voting ratio, about 60% in favour and 40% against. So I think if you're going to make these massive social changes in, I think both countries have got a strong conservative element, there's something to be said for a referendum, but a postal vote, and now the process has to go through Parliament,
which Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister, says he is going to do as expeditiously as possible, possibly even before Christmas. But Carol, Malcolm Turnbull is now, of course, trying to claim credit for Australia doing this. Politicians is, of course, in their nature to try and claim credit for things that happen on their watch, and frankly, on Turnbull so far, very little else has. But does he deserve any? He is the person who could have said, you know, dag nabbit, I'm the Prime Minister, this is the right thing to do and we're doing it. But he didn't. I mean, obviously, the political reasons for that are clear enough, that he has a sort of dingbat conservative wing of his party that he has to be concerned about. But really, is he allowed to get out in front of this and say, yay, I'm great?
Well, he probably feared a reception like the one that David Cameron got at his party conference. And clearly he was anxious not to take on some of those more conservative elements within his own party and within the country. And I'm sure that there will be people, perhaps in more remote parts of Australia, dare I say it, who won't be happy about this move. It does seem a bit of a ducking of responsibility to put it out there in a referendum. But, you know, that's what David Cameron did when it comes to Europe. And look where that led us with the Brexit referendum. So people have different views of referendums. Personally, I think, you know, if you have a representative democracy, then those who are elected should put forward the policies that they think are right, and then try to shape public opinion, accept the consequences when they get it wrong. But let's just say that in this case, the great Australian public have shown that they are enlightened, that this is what they want their politicians to do. And you showed us just before we came on air a wonderful picture on the front page
of the Geelong Advertiser. It is a ripper. I do recommend our listeners look it up. But they've discovered a couple of gay plumbers in Geelong who are now planning to get married, but photograph them, I think, dressed half in formal wear and half in work wear. It's the boots that make it, I think.
And I think it is worth remembering that there are more than 70 countries around the world where homosexuality is still outlawed. So good for Australia for taking this step. And let's hope for a bit more enlightenment in some of those other countries where gay people face a really, really difficult time.
Daniela, just for fun, the No campaign... obviously, the problem they face, not that I'm consumed with sympathy for them, is that you can't really run a campaign in this day and age saying, we're just cranks and bigots and we don't like gay people and that's why we're against this. So they did try to frame this as a religious freedom issue. Any sale?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I may be unpopular for saying this, but I do have some sympathy for them. And that's another reason why I think a referendum is not such a clumsy instrument for efforts such as these. I mean, obviously, I think it's a no-brainer. Clearly, all people of good faith and conscience, apart from religious people, maybe, would support gay marriage. But I think, practically speaking, amidst serious social change like this, you have to have buy-in from the general public, and it helps to people are involved and feel they have a chance to also make their objections felt as well. I think the result was a fantastic one, and the proportions, as I said, don't particularly surprise me coming after the experience of Ireland. But yeah, religious people hold an awful lot of kind of strange, quite strange and eccentric, in my opinion, ideas. But there has to be room for them to be able to express that as well.
The point being, of course, that nobody was ever going to stop them expressing them.
But it also has legal implications when it comes to, you know, you're going to march into a synagogue or a church and say, I want to get married to my boyfriend or my girlfriend. And will the church or synagogue then have to go along with it? I mean, that's a whole other kettle of fish. But that is for the legislators to bash out.
And it is worth remembering that in the UK, when same-sex marriage was introduced, a specific exemption was included, which allowed the churches to say whether or not they would agree to it happening actually within their church.
I mean, I wish the religions were as liberal and open-minded, as progressive as other people, but that's just a fact of life.
Daniela Peled and Carol Walker there speaking to Andrew Muller about Australia's vote on same-sex marriage. That wraps up this Monocle Daily, produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers, Daphne Cunizis and Alessia Delana. Our studio manager, Claire Urban. The Globalist will be here 8 hours from now at 7 a.m. London time, and this programme returns at 2200 in London tomorrow. For the moment, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.